The Jeff Weiler Columbus Auto Mall is turning up the heat this summer. Buy now with no down payment and no payments for 120 days.
That means no payments until fall. No payments until fall.
With over 8,000 cars, trucks, and SUVs available, there's something for every budget and lifestyle. Pick your ride, get approved, and drive home today with nothing due until autumn.
But hurry, these offers won't last forever.
Visit Jeff Weiler Columbus Auto Mall and take advantage while selection is strong.
Atlas Butler has convenient 2-hour service windows for heating, cooling, and plumbing service. Because nobody likes waiting around. You listening, BMB? Nobody likes waiting around.
Call 1-800-FURNACE.
They think we're lazy.
They think we're weak-willed.
They think we're entitled.
They think we're selfish.
They think we don't care about anybody but ourselves.
We are compassionate.
We are resourceful.
We are capable.
We want to make a difference in the world.
We are underestimated.
Chris, my son, my friend, I'll leave the light on for you.
Chris, I'll try to accomplish more tomorrow, and I'll leave the light on for you.
Exhausted and depressed, I went back to bed, but not before turning the light on for my son.
Extremely fatigued, still no word. I left the light on for my son.
To hell with everything, I'm going to bed. Once more, the light remained on for our son.
I am frustrated, bitter, and despondent. As I have done every night, I left the light on for Chris.
For the 706th time, I left the light on for Chris.
Once again, the light is on for you, Christopher. May the light's glow guide you safely home. We love you.
If you were to walk the neighborhoods in Bath Township from 1990 to 1992, you would notice something peculiar. At all times, one house's front porch light remained on. This light was left on by missing person Chris Temple's father. He hoped by leaving the light on, he could somehow guide Chris back home. He never stopped praying for his son's return. However, he would never see Chris walk back through his front door.
In the second episode of Voiceless, we explored the story of a young man named Chris Temple. We told you everything we did and did not know from the perspective of an investigator. And now we're returning in our second season to tell the story from the perspective of his father. After getting in contact with his sister, we had the opportunity to read his father's personal memoir, in which he details all of the pain and heartbreak he went through regarding his son's disappearance. We had the opportunity to view the case through a different lens and obtained information no one else has seen. The case of Chris Temple became even more real than ever for us. The memoir begins on April 22, 1990. It was a beautiful Earth Day with high temperatures and blossoming flowers, a day that Chris Temple chose to celebrate with friends at the Riverfront Park in Lansing. It was still early by the time his parents got home, and the family was not concerned in the slightest. In fact, this Sunday evening went by as all the previous ones had. By 9:30 p.m., his mother and little brother are in bed, his sister is studying, and his father is busy with the laundry. However, their ordinary life was interrupted by a phone call in Chris's room at 11:30. It was one of his friends, Nate Bennett, calling to ask if Chris had made it home safe. When his father replied that, no, he hadn't made it home yet, Nate gave a response that turned their world upside down. The boys had gone to Rose Lake Recreation Area after their little celebration at Riverfront Park, but no one had seen Chris since 9 p.m. Allegedly, the boys searched for him for hours before they gave up, figuring that he had just found a ride home. Chris's father was convinced that his son was in trouble at this point, so he woke his wife up, grabbed a flashlight, and they headed to Rose Lake. They arrived at 12:15 a.m. to the area where Chris was last seen, only to be met with fog and an inky darkness. Realizing that they were out of their depth, they drove 5 miles back home to officially report Chris missing. Once they got in contact with the proper jurisdiction, they made the return trip and collected Nate's account of the events on the way. According to Nate, 5 kids, Chris included, built a campfire at Rose Lake, made s'mores, and drank some beers. Around 9 p.m., Chris got up to relieve himself, where he was described as a weaving drunk. 15 minutes passed before they thought to look for him, but even after their search, they couldn't find him. It was getting around curfew for some of the boys, so they drove back to town, which was when Nate called Chris's father.
At 2 a.m., Captain Jack Phillips and 2 other Bath Township officers hit the scene, starting with the place where the boys supposedly had their bonfire. I say supposedly because Chris's father said, quote, "I'm not an outdoorsman, but as an old Boy Scout, I can at least tell where there has been a bonfire. And it didn't look like there had been a bonfire in recent memory, let alone 5 hours ago. There was no warmth at the fire site. The ground was cold. Furthermore, there was no wrappers, bottles, cigarette butts, or twigs for the s'mores. From the very beginning, Chris's father didn't trust those boys, and the police completely brushed him off. An hour later, at 3 a.m., the captain called in tracking dogs, which arrived by 4. In the time between, Chris's father drove into town once more to grab an article of clothing for the dogs to grab a scent and a picture of Chris. By this point, the parents fully expected to find their son asleep in a field somewhere, still unaware of the gravity of this situation. At 5:30 a.m., the dogs still hadn't found any trace of Chris. In fact, they'd found no human scent at all. Chris's father wrote it off as the heavy dew interfering with their ability to track smells. A helicopter was called in at some point as well, though it made little difference in the search. The parents were on and off the scene until the search was called off at 12. The police were 90% sure that Chris was not in the area, so by 12:45 on April 23rd, no one had a single clue as to what was going on. Throughout reading the memoir, one thing became very clear to me. Chris was not given the effort or attention from the police he deserved. As the memoir goes on, the police wrong him more and more. First off, Chris's disappearance is under Bath Township jurisdiction. However, the department was not open past 6 p.m. due to a lack of staff. Clinton police answered the phone instead. Immediately, this didn't sit right with me. Acting quickly is very important at times like these, and the time it took to contact Bath police could have been crucial to finding Chris. Most people believe that you can only report a person missing after they've been missing for at least 24 hours. However, this isn't true. In fact, the first 24 hours are the most important in terms of investigating a missing person. The police had the names of the boys Chris was with when he disappeared, and interviewed only one of them. This interview included a polygraph, which had tons of discrepancies and created more questions than answers. However, Bath Township never cleared up these discrepancies.
A week after Chris disappeared, still, not all of the boys that were there that night had been interviewed. It's important to interview witnesses as soon as possible, as the time they had could have allowed the boys to communicate with each other and set their story straight. Throughout the memoir, there is another common theme. Bath Township police do not communicate. They rarely spoke with Chris's father. In fact, if it weren't for his father constantly calling the police and demanding answers, I wonder if they would have ever updated him at all. They also had very closed-off communication with the private investigator. It was clear they didn't want to be working with him. In fact, psychics and private investigators were actually the ones to send items to a lab for testing. This is a responsibility that definitely should have been carried out by the police. There were also a huge number of insensitive things said by Bath Township police, and they just handled the case in a very crude way. At one point, there was supposed to be a search, however, the police called it off, calling the private investigator and telling him they don't go searching for dead bodies. A truly horrific thing to say about a missing 17-year-old. There were also a few times where there were potential sightings of Chris that Bath Township police just didn't follow up on because they said it was out of their jurisdiction. In a case like this, every last piece of information should be investigated and followed up on because you never know what could be groundbreaking for the case. Chris's disappearance wasn't even entered into the police database until 2 years later. Just how much important time was wasted because of these officers? The best example of their shoddy police work is a quote from page 363. Doug told Arlo he would be checking in about the inquiry made on May 3rd, 1990. That was written on March 5th, 1992, nearly 2 years late. The effort made from the police is always too little too late.
Throughout reading, I developed a horrific theory. What if Bath Township police were intentionally not trying as hard as they should to find Chris? He was involved in drug use and had difficulties in school. He was also made fun of a lot growing up, and he was not a very popular kid. Would they have handled the situation differently if Chris was a straight A, good in school, popular kid? Is there a chance they felt with him missing they didn't have to deal with him anymore? While I hope this theory is incorrect, the behavior described in the memoir makes it all the more plausible. The police chief, Jake Phillips, was even quoted saying, "It comes down to the basics of resources. Other crime obviously doesn't stop when there is a missing person. How long do you go before you stop and say, look, I've got other things to do?" This quote can almost act as a confession that they are aware they did not do what they should have for Chris. After countless letdowns from the police, Chris's father decided it was time to take matters into his own hands. He is determined for definitive answers. He even states, "I may not be able to handle the truth, but I need to know what happened to my son." He hires a private investigator named Arlo. Arlo helps him find tons of information, and they work closely together. Chris's father gives Arlo as much information as possible about Chris, while Arlo collects leads and looks into them. Chris's father even gets a couple calls claiming to be Chris, and he looks into every single one, with the help of Arlo. However, none are promising. He returns to the site where Chris disappeared multiple times, whether it be to feel closer to his son or to look for answers. He talks to anyone with possible leads, updates the media, and urges the police to keep looking. Through his searching, more and more possibilities are being exposed, each more tragic than the last. Throughout the memoir, one thing comes up pretty consistently: a cult. The first time this is mentioned is by an attorney who reaches out to Chris's father and informs him that there is an active cult in Shiawassee County. That county is just a mile from where Chris disappeared. The attorney found pictures of young boys at the site of animal sacrifices, but Chris's father did not recognize any of these boys as Chris or Chris's friends. The leader of this cult is also said to be a black man from Indianapolis who was, quote, into white slavery. The fact about the animal sacrifices surprised me a lot, because bones of small animals were found at the place Chris disappeared from. This obviously raises some concerns. Then, near the end of the memoir, a cult is mentioned again when an unidentified girl says that she was a part of the same cult as Chris. She said when she left, she was threatened and her family was harassed, so she speculated that something bad could have happened to Chris. I also developed my own theory that, if Chris was in this cult, he could have ran away out of fear of something happening to him or his family if he tried to leave. Him being involved in a cult could make sense, especially when you look at cults from that time period. Many involved drugs that Chris was typically using, such as marijuana. However, Chris's father said he would find it very surprising if Chris was involved in one, as it just didn't seem like him. This leads to the next theory, which seems to be what is accepted by law enforcement individuals, that Chris is a runaway. This comes up a couple times, and Chris's father is rightfully appalled by this theory. He, as well as us, refuses to believe that Chris ran away. Like we mentioned in our first episode about Chris, he was getting his life together in many ways. Chris's father also states that he doesn't believe his son would leave, and definitely wouldn't without saying goodbye to at least his little sister and brother.
To help with his investigation, Chris's father recruited the help of multiple psychics, who gave lots of interesting information. A psychic is a person that claims to have otherworldly powers or abilities. In this case, we are talking about the ability to contact individuals who are not present and perceive aspects of the past. According to a psychic named Phyllis, a man named Bill, Will, or William cornered Chris. They also said that Chris saw a new side of this person. Another psychic named Richard was used often. He gave Chris's father a lot of meaningful information. He mentioned that April 22nd, 23rd, and 24th are very important days for Chris. He also felt that Chris was a victim of violence at the campsite, and that he sensed the presence of two other individuals of Mexican descent were present. Richard went to Chris's home to see if he would have visions there too, and he did. While standing in Chris's rather lifeless bedroom, he had a very complex vision. He saw a white house with unusual steps leading to the front door. He saw that Chris walked down these steps with his hands behind his back, while two angry, nondescript males followed behind him. He believed this house to be on Stoll Road. This road is located just under a mile from Rose Lake Park. Richard also went to Rose Lake to see if he'd feel anything different there, and he reported back that he felt Chris's presence, as well as a feeling of being watched. Carol, another psychic, around a month after his disappearance, told Chris's father that she felt he was still alive, as well as the fact that he struggled with drug use. While this information is by no means reliable or 100% fact, I think it's still really interesting to see what they came up with. While reading, we could also tell the things the psychics were saying brought hope for not only his son's well-being, but also the investigative process of this case.
Chris's father and Arlo ran into a couple of other leads as well. One man from Florida called the tip line set up for Chris and said that he stayed at the same hostel as Chris on the 1st and 2nd of August. This hostel was a youth hostel in Bellingham, Washington. He said a man who looked to be in his late teens or early 20s came into the hostel with two younger women. He was wearing wire-rimmed glasses and was in good shape. The caller said he didn't recall the name, but the hostel had a guest book that everyone signs and gave the information of the owners to Chris's father to ask to receive the sign-in book. Chris's father reviewed the information with his wife, and they had differing opinions. She didn't believe the man described was Chris. The caller said the man talked about skiing in Colorado, and to their knowledge, their son had never been skiing. Then, when asked more specific questions, the man became avoidant. It's possible that it could be Chris, because he had a bit of knowledge about many things, but would back down if he believed things became too technical. Chris's father believed that it could be him. The mysterious man wore glasses, and Chris had contact lenses left at home. He was very intelligent and articulate and could be outgoing, depending on the people and his mood. However, none of this information can be confirmed, because when they tried to get a copy of the guest book, they were told that the hostel valued the privacy of those staying there. They would not give information to them without a warrant. While the privacy of youth in hostels is important, is it more important to find a missing child?
The Jeff Weiler Columbus Auto Mall is turning up the heat this summer. Buy now with no down payment and no payments for 120 days.
That means no payments until fall. No payments until fall.
With over 8,000 cars, trucks, and SUVs available, there's something for every budget and lifestyle. Pick your ride, get approved, and drive home today with nothing due until autumn. But hurry, these offers won't last forever. Visit Jeff Weiler Columbus Auto Mall and take advantage while selection is strong.
You hear that? That's the sound of Pepsi Zero Sugar, the better tasting, more refreshing Zero Sugar Cola. Listen to that endless pour. Pure refreshment. If it sounds this good, just imagine how it tastes. Oh yeah, so good. Pepsi Zero Sugar. Let your taste decide.
We interrupt this program to bring you an important Wayfair message. Wayfair's got style tips for every home. This is Styles McKenzie helping you make those rooms sing. Today's style tip. When it comes to making a statement, treat bold patterns like neutrals. Go wild, like an untamed animal print area rug under a rustic farmhouse table from Wayfair.com. Arr, fierce. This has been your Wayfair style tip to keep those interiors superior.
Wayfair, every style, every home.
You hear that? That's the sound of Pepsi Zero Sugar, the better tasting, more refreshing Zero Sugar Cola. Listen to that endless pour. Pure refreshment. If it sounds this good, just imagine how it tastes. Oh yeah, so good. Pepsi Zero Sugar. Let your taste decide.
Days after Chris disappeared at 1 a.m., the family's phone began to ring. Just being woken up, Chris's father didn't make it to the phone before the answering machine took a tape of the voice message. The voice on the other line said he was Chris and left a phone number he could be reached by. Chris's father played the tape for Tani twice, and once again, she does not believe the caller was actually Chris, as the voices didn't quite match. Chris's father also pointed out that the caller didn't say "I love you" at the end of the call, as Chris always did. The caller also said they were in California, but the area code was from Pennsylvania. They tried to call the number back, but got no answers. The call wouldn't go through. The number didn't exist. Their hopes were crushed, and there was nothing they could do.
There were a variety of tips in this case that were never investigated by police. Nearly 2 years later, through the efforts of Chris's father, these tips were turned over to Arlo. While many of these tips have questionable validity, there is one that stood out to both me and Chris's family. A young woman in California claimed to have lived with Chris for 2 weeks, more than just a brief glance. In this time frame, he had told her that his name was Chris Temple and that he was a runaway from Michigan. Finally, there was a substantial lead to chase down, and Chris's father did exactly that. He started by placing all manner of calls, which led to bureaucratic nonsense. Once he could finally get someone from the National Center for Missing Persons on the line, he was told that the name and number on the tip sheet could only be released to the investigating police force. So, the state police could request the records, and then they could release the information if they wished. I understand privacy, but denying their own flesh and blood only for this unnecessary workaround? How many times will these investigating offices delay this investigation? 3 days later, the information that could have been obtained in just 1 day is received. The woman who submitted the tip was named Sharon Singer from Lodi, California. At 8 p.m. on March 23rd, they made their attempt to call Shannon. She was willing to help, which was a relief, but her memory was foggy on account of the event happening in October of 1991. According to Sharon, he was using the name Alan Vollmer, and he was from Michigan. He told her that he had a 13-year-old sister named Sarah Lee, his mother's name was Lucy, and that he had been kicked out of the house. He also confided in her that he had gotten his girlfriend pregnant, who was now in a mental hospital. Apparently, there were warrants out for his arrest, which was why he fled the state. He had been hitchhiking until a truck driver picked him up and dropped him off in California, which is where he met Sharon. Nothing about that story seems like Chris. Suddenly, neither of the parents were convinced that this was a probable lead anymore, and it broke their hearts. Chris's father wrote, "More disappointment. The worst part is that we felt this was our best lead of the whole bunch. Back to square one, again. Disappointed and saddened, we went to bed. Once more, the light is on for you, Chris." He no longer believed that person was Chris, but he couldn't stop looking. He asked the Bath Township Police Sergeant to check out the name Alan Vollmer, only to be met with more disappointment a day later. There were no warrants for a person with that name. There wasn't even a license issued. Whoever it was that lived with Sharon, whether or not it was Chris, there was no way of finding him. Across the next month of the memoir, Chris's father detailed his continued correspondence with Sharon from California. Time and time again, she gave anecdotes that sounded less and less like Chris, and less believable as a whole. It had gone from 2 weeks to an entire month that they had stayed together, and even having spent so much time with him, she didn't seem to know him very well at all. This tip, their most promising lead so far, gave nothing of significance to the case, and I don't believe Chris's father ever recovered from the letdown. This was the straw that broke the camel's back, so to speak. This was the culmination of 2 years of dealing with incompetent police agencies, thousands of dollars spent on psychics and private investigators, and he had nothing to show for it. He was no closer to finding his son than he had been 2 years ago.
Reading this memoir was honestly very hard for me. The whole time, I felt so frustrated that there were no answers, and this frustration was amplified by the emotions Chris's father felt. Once I started getting to the end of the memoir, my heart was breaking. Just reading it, you could tell how depressed and hopeless Chris's father felt, and it honestly made me feel similar. I think when you read something this powerfully written, you absorb, even if just a fraction of, some of the pain the author has while writing.
For me, the memoir only got more heartbreaking as it continued. We experienced every up and down that Chris's father did over the course of those arduous 2 years, all while knowing that, 35 years later, his son still hasn't been found. Chris was robbed of his future and so many milestones, yet Sean and Tawny continued to grow. As time passed and Chris's younger brother Sean aged, their father began to draw more parallels between his two sons. He wrote that Sean looks exactly like Chris did at his age, and he began to be interested in all the same things. Tennis, piano lessons, and the Cub Scouts. Every extracurricular was followed by the haunting memories of Chris's childhood. I feel this excerpt from page 225 describes the family's pain best. "Time is supposed to be the great healer, but in this case, it is the enemy. Each day that passes puts us further away from knowing the truth. For others, life goes on, while the Temple family is left in stasis."
On Wednesday, April 22, 1992, the Temple family reached the milestone of the second anniversary of their son's disappearance. The private investigator, Arlo, and the lead investigator, Doug, would be going to Rose Lake to reenact all the events of the night, as told by the boys who were there. Chris's parents would be going as well, but not for the same reasons. However, before night fell and they went to the Wildlife Center, Chris's father recorded an interview with Channel 10 News, in which he gave a harsh review of how law enforcement carried out their investigation. After work, he saw the story of a local girl who had gone missing dominated the news, so much that they devoted a mere 30 seconds to Chris's story. Once more, he had been brushed aside and ignored. To quote his father, "This has been a pattern since day one. Christopher's disappearance obviously never captured the public's attention. He was not pretty like those girls, nor was he sick like Jack Austin, another teenager who disappeared. No big deal, except to his family." At 8:30 p.m., Chris's parents arrived at Rose Lake to somehow try to communicate with him through thoughts and prayers. A bit difficult to do when Channel 10 news people were in their faces all night. Marty Mestimacher, a friend of Chris's, also showed up to pay his respect. He left two cigarettes and an empty cassette with a note inside, his way of saying goodbye to Chris.
The case was discussed until 10:30 p.m. when his parents decided to call it a night. The drive home was silent, as both were confused and immersed in their thoughts. Yet another night goes by with what feels like no progress. His father wrote on page 395, "The day closes with the same fear, frustration, and anguish as that night 2 years ago. Now, as then, the light is on for Chris." And that was the end of the memoir as it was written. Both the story being told and the investigation being carried out by Chris's father were brought to a close, just as somberly as they had begun. But that isn't the end of our story. Chris still hasn't been found, and we will do everything in our power to ensure that his family can finally find closure. Those efforts begin right here, with this podcast.
Oftentimes, as years and years go by, people forget about those who are missing. Their family passes away and bring along with them the memories of the missing person. Cases go cold with no attention or new information being given. Though Chris's parents have passed and his father stopped writing in the memoir, Chris Temple will not be forgotten. We made sure of it. For me and Gracie, this project wasn't just 6th and 7th hour of our junior year. It was something meaningful, something that carried real weight in the world and that would impact a missing person we had never met. It's a way to make ourselves useful. We were dedicated to this episode in particular to share the story of not only Chris, but a desperate man plagued by loss. By researching and producing this podcast, we hope to continue what Chris's father started, the search for Chris Temple. We hope to bring not only new information to the case, but new eyes as well. We want to advocate for Chris and encourage anyone with information to step forward, no matter how insignificant it seems. With help from anyone who knows anything and other investigative forces, we have a chance to find Chris Temple.
Voiceless was researched, written, and produced by Gracie, Madison, Haley, Olivia, Asia, and Chloe. Intro music by Haley, all other music by Shane Yoder. Our show artwork was created by Chelsea, and our series artwork was created by Olivia and Madison. The Underestimated Podcast is a production created in the Brandywine Community Schools Broadcasting CTE program. We want to thank you for listening, and a huge thank you to our community sponsors for supporting us and helping to fund our work. Please make sure to leave us a review on your favorite podcast player, and we'll be back next week with another episode of Underestimated.
The Jeff Weiler Columbus Auto Mall is turning up the heat this summer. Buy now with no down payment and no payments for 120 days.
That means no payments until fall. No payments until fall.
With over 8,000 cars, trucks, and SUVs available, there's something for every budget and lifestyle. Pick your ride, get approved, and drive home today with nothing due until autumn.
But hurry, these offers won't last forever.
Visit Jeff Weiler Columbus Auto Mall and take advantage while selection is strong.
Sally from finance loves fly fishing. She used to spend her weekend surrounded by receipts. Then she switched her company to Ramp. Now, spend is all under control, all in one place. Her team submits their expenses with a text, and she can close the books without all the busy work. So Sally's weekends are all her own, surrounded by fish, not receipts. Switch your business to ramp.com and love finance again.